So when I decided to be very public about what we went through, and a lot of folks say, "Well, why would you do that?" And the reason being is that it has been affirmed for me it was the right thing to do, because so many people will write in or call in and say, for example, "Now I know what my grandmother went through."
That was the Honorable Lisa Rayett, former Cabinet Minister and Member of Parliament from 2008 to 2019, and caregiver to her husband Bruce, who was diagnosed with young onset Alzheimer's disease during the pandemic. In this episode, we talk about their experience facing this illness, how the seven keys can be useful for caregivers, and what policies can help caregivers along an illness journey.
Hi, I'm Xian Xiao.
And I'm Sammy Winemaker. We talk to people who have information and tips on how to unlock a better illness experience.
The waiting room revolution starts right now.
We are very excited today. Today we have the Honorable Lisa Ray on our podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Welcome.
Yeah, and of course, people might know you from your life in politics, but today we're really talking about another part of your life, which you've also been fairly public about, which is your role as a caregiver.
Yep, that's right. Happy to talk about what our family has been doing.
Yeah, and so maybe we can start at the beginning. I mean, what was it like when you first were starting to enter into this healthcare world, you know, when you realized someone that you loved was changing?
Yeah, you know, we're 8 years post-diagnosis. So I've evolved in my thinking around this question. And I'll tell you, I do think about it from how you just said it now, which is my first introduction to the healthcare system with somebody who has young onset Alzheimer's, who is young, 56 years old. So the beginning was his work noticing something was wrong. It wasn't me. He was missing meetings. He wasn't able to read documents as well. He certainly was disappearing and acting erratically. His board, he was a CEO. His board was thinking that he had a substance abuse problem, to be honest. And they brought in experts to do a review, which of course means getting ready for firing. And when I got wind of it, when he told me what was going on, I got really concerned because it wasn't like him. It didn't make any sense. That he was struggling because work he loved. He absolutely loved work. And I didn't notice anything at home. I noticed that when we were deciding on places to go, he would always let me choose. I actually ordered his food. And I knew that that Christmas before he was diagnosed, I was with him at his Christmas party. And he just practiced and practiced and practiced his Christmas speech, which he would normally just do off the top of his head. And he was just really freaked out about it. And I thought, what is wrong with you? He did say to me at some point in time, there's something wrong with my head. I don't know what it is. So I said, it probably vitamin B deficiency, you know, go see your doctor. Everything that he did with his regular family doctor was perfect. It was excellent. Doctor sent him for the right tests. So he goes to see his doctor. And his doctor does this. I know this after the fact, by the way. Doctor does the general test for dementia, which is, I'm going to tell you three words. We're going to have a conversation. And then you'll tell me back the three words. And then they talked about golf because they were golfing buddies. Anyway, he ended up getting no medication. He got the doctor's note to go off work. Stress related is what they said. And then he also got a referral to a doctor. And I didn't pay any attention to what the referral was because I was busy. I was in Parliament. I was in opposition, just trying to get used to my new roles. And I got a phone call from the doctor's office. So that was in February. In March, the doctor's office, the referenced doctor, called me and said, the nurse said, "And we need you to accompany Mr. Wood." And I went, "Oh, okay, that's interesting." They must be putting those drops in his eyes where he can't drive anymore. And I thought, but maybe I should look up who I'm going to see. Night before, I Googled the name of the doctor and it says gerontologist. I went, well, that's really odd. What could this be about? Never thinking Alzheimer's.
And well, then because he's 56. And so why would my 56-year-old husband be referred to a gerontologist? Yeah.
Right. So we walked in, we're separated. And I think, looking back, what my advice to the people in this place would be, don't assume that the wife or the husband know why they're there.
Yeah.
Because the family doc did not say, I suspect you have Alzheimer's and I'd like to get a second opinion. He never said that. He just said, I think you should go see this person. So we were, it may have been better that we didn't worry for 6 weeks, but man, I felt like I was punched in the throat when the doctor came out. It was just so shocking. And to hear it, because we weren't seeking that diagnosis. And immediately I got combative. And I said, I want a second opinion. I want the test. I want to know the blood test. Tell me, you know, diagnostics. And he said, I've been doing this a long time. This is Alzheimer's. And we didn't tell my husband the diagnosis, because during the testing, he became so emotional and, as a foreshadow, so menacing that they just stopped the testing. And then we went from there. And then I took him home and that was it. That was it. So then I struggled to figure out what to do. And I called a friend of mine and I said, didn't the government give money to Baycrest at some point in time for brain health or something? Do you know anybody there that I can call? And I called and they brought him in and he got a second opinion, was Alzheimer's, told us how far along. Bruce was brought through the whole process. But then after that, Bruce refused to go see a doctor ever again. That was it. So that was the introduction to the healthcare. And no, here's the number for Alzheimer's Canada. Here's the number to do this. Here's a list of the things that you may be concerned about. This was 16. Things may have changed, but nothing. I was then left to Google everything. And you know how dangerous that is, guys. I mean, thank goodness you're out there trying to fill in the blanks. But man, that was, and I read every book and I will read your book too. So that's the beginning story. Long story, but I think it's important for people to understand that it wasn't a situation where we were searching for the diagnosis. What could possibly be wrong? It was, oh, we got the diagnosis almost when we just didn't expect to get the diagnosis.
And in many ways that is, you know, people's world change upside down. Even if they're suspecting something, they're hoping it's not true. And so we meet patients all along the way. So Sammy's a palliative care physician. She works in patients' homes strictly, and I'm a palliative care researcher. But we hear this all the time. And whether you're expecting it or not, you're never really can wrap your head around it until it happens. And people's world just changes in an instant, never to be the same. And in some ways, I'm curious, what were some of the big changes that you weren't prepared for? Like, how did your life change after that? I know in so many ways, in every way, probably, but for yourselves, for your family, what was that like?
So my mindset was everything in my world changed from being hopeful in the outlook of what was coming in the future for us, the planning for retirement, what trips we're going to go on, kids having weddings, having grandchildren. That was all not allowed to be thought of anymore in my mind. The reason being is that Bruce was not going to be able to enjoy those things. So my mindset focused just to the day to day. And I'm going to be brutally honest, it also kind of unleashed on me this absolute need to know, well, how long is this going to go on for? Because I was 47. And I just didn't know how long to be prepared. Like, at what point does he get sick? At what point does this happen? And I guess the answer to all that is, it depends. Every case is kind of different. So my world got super small, super small, and became completely entwined with his. And that's the way it was until still is. He just lives in a long-term care facility now.
So it sounds like what you're describing is actually grieving. I think many people don't realize that people begin to grieve even before they've lost someone.
I think that's really insightful. I would agree that that's it. And it's at different times, like different turning points of this disease, the grief comes back and hits you again. My defense mechanism now is I don't think about the stuff I'm losing. And I try not to get frustrated. You kind of numb yourself to all of that, which isn't healthy, I know, but this is my coping mechanism. But sometimes it comes through. And I know a couple of weeks ago, an old friend of ours wrote and said, how is Bruce doing? He lives in the States now. And I wrote him back a nice note telling him where Bruce was. and what was going on. And he keeps in touch, so he knew what was happening. And then I wrote back and I said, well, you must be excited because Super Bowl, his team is in it, blah, blah, blah. And he says, well, as a matter of fact, we're in Las Vegas this weekend because we got tickets to the Sphere. And he was talking about how another couple friend of ours was there. And boy, in that moment, I was distraught. Like the grief came over me because that should have been us. And it wasn't, I wasn't angry. I was so sad. So sad.
Would you believe that those moments of grief are really important? Because this is called anticipatory grief, and it is something that is actually protective for someone to ready themselves for losses. And not just the big loss eventually, but the losses along the way, like the loss of social connection, the loss of your independence as you knew it before, or your loss of freedom to travel wherever. If we bury ourselves and get ourselves so busy that we don't attend to, moments of grief, then it will come at you like a tidal wave down the road. And so it is important that you allow your mind to go there, because it's helping you have little sips of grief so that it's not a tsunami downstream.
That is good advice. And it's true. You do grieve the little things along the way. And what you described is exactly what I've done. This summer, Bruce got, or actually last February, Bruce got COVID and became quite sick. And I was worried that this was it. And I felt a whole different level of grief in that moment. Luckily, antibiotics worked. And I chose to treat as opposed to not treating. And that's a choice for people. I get that. At that point in time, that's the choice I made for Bruce, was to treat it, and he bounced back. But boy, I got an insight into loss. And I just kept saying to myself, I'm not ready to let go yet.
Yeah, my understanding, from people who have been caregivers, of someone with dementia is because it is such a long journey, that spans years and years, that you almost in the craziest way adjust and readjust and readjust. And so that when you are faced with the big loss, the threat of losing the person, it almost feels like as fresh as the diagnosis, because you have just been, it's become part of your, how should I say this in quotations, normal life again after the diagnosis. And so the loss seems fresh. So I think that's what you were experiencing when you had a near, when you were contemplating the fact that he could die from that infection.
It's true. And my new normal is getting updates twice a day and pictures of him just to see how he's doing. And I don't know what my life looks like after that. Like it does, even though he's in a different facility where I live, it's still there constantly.
I would suggest that I don't look know what your life will look like either, but trends usually continue. So if you've been a person that has been able to be nimble and flexible and adjust like you have to the many changes that you have faced, and the fact that you have begun your grieving process, you may surprise yourself that at the time when you do lose him, if I can speak
Yeah,
openly,
of
it
course.
will be a tidal wave. But you might surprise yourself that you can move through it, and life will, not swallow you up afterwards, because you've already proven you have a track record now. I mean, the caregiver of someone with Alzheimer's, if it doesn't eat you up and you are able to, get through every hurdle, you're going to continue to get through every hurdle with the same coping mechanisms you've already used. So I
I
think you're going to
appreciate
be okay, even though you're going to be sad.
that. I appreciate that. You said something at the beginning, though, and it's the making yourself busy and filling all of your time so that you don't feel the grief. And that's exactly how I'm dealing with it. I work all the time.
Then that is a strong coping mechanism that you have.
Yeah.
And I don't think you should feel guilty for it because
okay, good.
It's protecting you and it's keeping you afloat. And I wouldn't say that it's so much so that you're in any kind of denial. It's just, that's the way you cope. And if that's the way you've always coped through every challenge in your life, is it okay if I call you Lisa?
Yes, seems I feel so like informal. You're my therapist right now, Sammy, so keep going.
No, I'm just sharing like information because I think the listeners will appreciate that there's so many people that are in the same situation. So yeah, but we say that in our book, there's a whole chapter about know your style. And so it's really just finding some peace in the fact that you are who you are. And the way you walk a journey should be no surprise to you and rather predictable because we've all had challenges in our past and we know how we have, for better or worse, moved through them. So you're going to harness the same kinds of coping mechanisms. So I think it's okay. I really do.
Appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the questions that I had was, you know, you were in federal politics, you understand the systems. What were some of the things that surprised you along the journey that weren't, you know, I guess safety nets that weren't there that you thought, wow, I can't believe that this was so hard to get done? You know, not, I mean, it's a long journey, not everything, but what were some of the big things that you were like, I can't believe that this wasn't more streamlined and easier to get access to?
So I've thought about this a lot, and where I've landed is you're only as good as the human that you're dealing with in the chain. Right. So sometimes you get somebody who's fantastic and they lead you in the right path. And sometimes you don't get that great help that you need to have. And for me, everything was just a little too late. By the time we qualified for something, we had passed the need. The example would be respite care or home assistance. And by the time I was approved, it was just too late because Bruce was at a point where he wasn't sleeping at night at all, roaming around the house, and they were afraid of him. So there was no time to get people used to one another. It was like somebody coming in at the end, and you needed a security guard, not a personal care worker at that point. And that's, you know, we're very specific to that kind of issue, but that's kind of where it was. By the time we qualified for whatever it was that the care system could offer, it was plentiful, but it just, we were beyond it. We were firmly in, by the time we needed to have respite, we were at the point where we needed long-term care. And that, but I will tell you from the bigger picture, and I know I can talk broader policy with you from all of my experience. I think society's made a fundamental mistake in the past number of years of assuming that we can age in place, because my experience with dementia and my observations of the residents in the place where Bruce is that there's no family who can handle that for the period of time that dementia can linger in stage 7, if you think about it in that way, right? Where the person needs constant care. That can go on for years and years and years. And I don't think it's fair for society to assume that the family is going to do it.
Hey, listeners, you're halfway through the episode. We want to remind you that our book, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest, is available everywhere you buy books, in softcover, audiobook, and ebook. And did you know you can leave a review on Amazon without purchasing directly from Amazon? All you need is an account. And reviews help others find our book when they need it the most. So thanks for your support, and there's lots more to this great episode, so keep listening.
It really also depends on, you know, if there are a lot of behaviors and safety issues versus, you know, a very lamb-like situation because they do vary. But yeah, certainly if you have aggression or combativeness, wandering, that's very difficult, very difficult. Well, do you mind me asking, what stage was Bruce when he was diagnosed?
He was diagnosed at 3, stage 3.
So moderate. Early, like early moderate, like
Early
moderate.
moderate,
Yeah.
exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Did he have insight into what his diagnosis was? No.
No.
Okay.
See, so this was the problem. He was diagnosed so far along
Yeah.
as a lawyer, I was concerned about capacity,
Yes.
right? Can he? So we literally went to the lawyer to make sure the will and the power of attorney was proper. And the lawyer satisfied himself that Bruce had the capacity to do that. I mean, I don't know what I would have done if it was any later.
Yeah, and when you did, when you both got the diagnosis, because it's like when people say we are pregnant because basically both have it. Did you were you even though he was early mid stage, were you able to talk to him about what his wishes
Palliative
were?
care.
Well, yeah, not even palliative care, but like, what does this mean for us, Bruce? What are what? How do you see this unfolding? Do you have anything you want me to know so that I can honor your care as things change going forward? Like, did anyone help you to have those conversations, or did you think to have them, or were you just scrambling?
I wish I had them. When he would
Yeah.
try to broach long term with him, he would just shut down and say, I hate this disease. I don't think he had the capacity to think in that kind of long term scenario. I mean, to give you some granularity, he got diagnosed around the point where he couldn't pack for a vacation. We went to Israel when I was in Parliament, and he arrived with three pairs of he took no pants with him and no suit jacket. So it was just shorts, and we had to scramble to try. So he couldn't do that executive functioning. So he lost that. When you lose the executive functioning, how can you talk about long-term planning? So what we focused on was the here and now, and he liked talking to people about getting the diagnosis and making sure that you kept healthy and how important it was to get a cure. And that's kind of where he kept his world. And after a while, he couldn't do that. After about 18 months, he couldn't do that anymore. But to illustrate your point, I would have loved, honestly, someone to take me by the hand and say, look, and not a book. I'm sorry, books are helpful, but sometimes you just need somebody to take you and sit with you quietly and say, here's the questions that you need answered. Because I don't know where Bruce wants to be buried. I don't know how he wants to go out of this life. I have no idea. All I have is his existing POA, which is clear that I'm to use every means possible to keep him alive. I don't know if he had known what that looks like, would he have wanted that? So I'm lost, and it's a big chunk of the puzzle that I'm missing, and it opens me up to making decisions that I worry are wrong.
I think what you're referring to, Lisa, and I hear you, is when you went to the lawyer way back, that Bruce would have acknowledged what types of interventions he wanted down the road and which ones he wouldn't, right? So, do you want a feeding tube? Do you want resuscitation? Do you want antibiotics? Like all these things. At a time when it wasn't really contextualized, he was better back then as he is now. But you're left wondering, what do you do with those wishes that he put on paper? How do you honor them? And you know, you might be surprised when I tell you that those were not, that information was not to be literal. Those are not literal decisions that the person wants. They are presented as literal, but they're not. Because you have to take that and contextualize it later in his illness and wonder if he would still want that or not. So, what I mean by that is to say it's often more helpful to think about less about if he said he wanted a feeding tube or not. Not that that would be helpful. We can talk about that, but less about at the time when he said, I want to live forever, but more about in your relationship with him before he got diagnosed, what were the things that were important to him and what did he value? So for example, if it was his independence and his ability to take care of himself and to control his environment and to be with family and to be able to travel. And those are the kind of things that are more helpful for someone who's in a decision-making role to think about later in the illness. So if there is something that comes your way, you have to make a decision about treating something, then think less about that document and more about what would Bruce tell me he wanted right now, based on how he's always lived his life. And, you know, he may have signed that paper for resuscitation, but he would not want to live like this. And it doesn't mean you're dishonoring that page. So I would take it less literally.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've attempted to take him to, he had a stomach ailment this summer. We've never tracked down what it was. He was vomiting. I was worried it was something serious like appendicitis. Mm-hmm. And because they don't do care in the long-term care home, right? It's not hospital. I took him to an emergency room, and it was possibly, I mean, I've learned from that mistake, but he was terrified. Mm-hmm. It was just so difficult. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, like the doctor said, even if they did discover something, would I really operate on him? Would I really subject him to anesthesia or even an IV? He would rip it out. Mm-hmm. So that's helpful. That, but I had to go through it, I think, to learn that.
I would, I have a question about policy. I know you've stepped away from politics, but you know a lot about policy making and, you know, how different systems work. So I guess, where do you see some opportunities for improving, you know, supports for caregivers? Like, what are some ideas you might have seen other places, or you think have some momentum here that you think could actually work in our Canadian environment?
Yeah, I think when we get to a certain stage in dementia and Alzheimer's specifically, I know it's going to sound weird, I like the US model of hospice, where people just take the decision that, okay, it's comfort only, and we will have somebody who's there on call to attend to our needs for comfort if needed and do medication that way. But you can either have it in a long-term home or you can have it in your own home. I don't see that in our system. I don't see that dignity in dying in our system. And I wish there was more of that. I think caregivers can take the decision to place their loved one on hospice, as they say in the States, or in hospice, because palliative care, and this is my understanding, and you guys are the experts, but from my experience with my mom, palliative care, oftentimes the place wants to keep its time limited. So, you know, over 21 days, if the person is going to be around for more than 21 days, it's may not necessarily be an option. I could be completely wrong, but that's the way it was presented to me. It's a short-term thing. You go there at the end of your days, kind of thing for active dying. And that makes sense, because you don't want all those rooms filled with people for long periods of time. With Alzheimer's, you never know when that's going to happen. So a lot of cases, you know, having them on hospice at home for that longer period of time, as opposed to palliative care, which can come later on when they get to the active dying part, that would make sense to me to somehow introduce that into the system.
Well, you might be relieved to know that there's a lot of advocacy going on right now to change the way people think about palliative care. So palliative care, yes, it is a service, and it is a specialty, like I'm a palliative care specialist. But, you know, we talk as much now about what's called a palliative approach, which is a philosophy of palliative care that's peppered into any serious illness journey and does not have to be delivered by a palliative care specialty team, so that every geriatrician and neurologist and nurse and family physician know what the storyline of these progressive illnesses look like, and they can help a patient and a family identify what is this roadmap, the big picture of this illness. What are the major milestones going to look like and the decision points? What is the person's goals of care and what do they value? And be able to dance across chronic disease management and a philosophy of palliative care just naturally woven in to the care that people receive.
Agreed.
So one of the things that I heard you say at this conference we met at was that a lot of people look to the government and hope that the government can solve all the issues. And you've talked about how it can't be left, you know, to just the government, you know, public private partnerships, communities taking the lead. And what we're trying to do with our work at the Waiting Room Revolution is to educate the public. And I just wonder what your reactions are to this idea of, I guess it is public education, but it really is about teaching patients and families how to be a patient, how to be a caregiver, because these are roles that no one ever wanted or signed up for, but got bestowed on you. And there's no course, or not yet anyways, on how to do that well. And I think from our vantage point, we have a lot of insight and of course, working with other people in the research to be like, if they had this information, they would have made different choices.
So when I decided to be very public about what we went through, and a lot of folks say, well, why would you do that? And the reason being is that it has been affirmed for me it was the right thing to do, because so many people will write in or call in and say, for example, now I know what my grandmother went through. I didn't realize she had to look after my grandfather like that, and I know better. A lot of people will say, well, my grandmother had Alzheimer's, so I understand. Not really. Yeah, especially with spouses. And you know, the area, guys, that I'm really concerned about in early onset are the kids. Because we have no idea what kind of impact this is having on them and what that does to them going forward. And there are no supports for kids, like zero. There's no kids helpline. Like, who are you going to call into? It's it's real a tough situation. So
there is.
I like what you're doing.
Yeah, thank
Go
you.
Ahead.
There is the Canadian Grief Alliance, and there is an organization for grieving kids, and they absolutely understand that grief starts before a death. So there's a whole bunch of organizations across Canada. It's called the Canadian Center for Grieving Children, I think. Actually, we're doing a talk with them in June, and a lot of them, there's child life specialists. It is about, it is exactly about what you're talking about, just sharing that, preparing themselves for what to expect. What are they feeling? What are they, how are they processing this? And how are they staying hopeful? But what are they hoping for? But what also are they planning for? And what does this mean for their own lives? And just being able to find a place to talk about that. Otherwise, it becomes like what you say, it's kind of hidden in the back. And then suddenly, you know, it unleashes. And that's not necessarily healthy.
And it's not healthy for the caregiver. And we know the statistics that caregivers oftentimes can, well, their loved one outlives them just because of the stress that's on them. And and that's, I like the idea of very much of engaging and educating people in the larger sense, because that thirst for that knowledge is there. It's always the challenge of how to get it through, right? How do you communicate that? But I will share with you one of the most impactful pieces of support that I've received is joining a weekly, and this is the key, a weekly consistent support group, much like in a Zoom kind of, it is a Zoom call. And it's moderated by a social worker, and it's free of charge. It's from the United States. It's not from Canada. But I know that the associations that deal with dementia in Canada do that, but they do it so infrequently. It's once a month, or it's a cafe and you bring your loved one. I think specifically spouses of young onset, I mean, you can find a lot of similarities. And I think seeing, I'm old now in the group, like, because and the younger people coming in are going through the stuff I went through 3-4 years ago, and we can offer that kind of advice. So you're right, educating people so that they understand and have a place to go is extremely, extremely important.
Yeah, and we are not just educating and raising awareness, we're actually activating people so that people aren't as passive or assuming that they have the information that they need. And so we're trying to give them the language and the permission and that they know their rights to information, and not just the day-to-day information, but Alzheimer's has a very well mapped out roadmap.
Yeah.
It is possible to understand the big picture of Alzheimer's and what the main decision points are going to be and what the very end stage of this illness looks like. It is possible to predict when someone is likely in their last year of Alzheimer's, and then last months, weeks, or days. It is possible to have that information if it is important to someone.
Mm-hmm. That's really good. That's really good advice.
We like to end our interviews with, you know, what brings you hope? What are you hopeful for in the future?
Oh, I'm hopeful for the future because of folks like yourselves who are normalizing caregiving, and especially with dementia patients. It's no longer something hidden away that you're afraid to talk about, I think. I mean, I'm certainly, maybe it's because I'm approachable and people will come and talk to me about it. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, dementia is still talked in whispers, but the more mm-hmm. this stuff comes out, especially with the Canadian mm-hmm. kind of view on it, I think mm-hmm. that's super important. So mm-hmm. that gives me hope, to be honest. It's not 2016 anymore. 2024 mm-hmm. is very different for people. Mm-hmm. And I mean, what doesn't give me hope is I don't see the medical interventions needed for Alzheimer's. Yeah. So it mm-hmm. all focuses on how to manage it as opposed to how to moderate or mitigate it or mm-hmm. cure it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be nice.
Yeah. Yeah. We need all hands on deck. Well, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, thank you for joining us, Lisa. It's been
Thanks,
great to
yeah.
talk to you.
Appreciate it. No, really good to talk to you guys.
Yeah.
Thank you for being so open and genuine and sharing your own personal story with us.
Hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe if you haven't already. Visit our website, waitingroomrevolution.com, for more information, to join our newsletter, and to check out our book, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest. This podcast is produced by myself, Kayla McMillan, Shilpa Jyothi Kumar, and Maggie Sivek. And our theme music is Maypole by Ketsa.